Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. What will the future of food look like? Some say that the only way we'll be able to feed ourselves in the future is through an expansion of agribusiness reliant on GMOs and pesticides. But there's another vision of the future that involves creating crops that regenerate the soil that they're grown in, worker organizations that fight exploitation right down the supply chain, and the rebuilding of local sustainable food networks. This morning, we talk with Anna LaPay, food writer and activist, about how we can and must create a more equitable and sustainable food system. Anna, a founder of the Small Planet Institute and director of Real Food Media, served as guest editor for the recent special issue of The Nation magazine about the future of food. Well, Anna, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you. It's so great to be back.
Right. I think it's been about 9 years. I'm not sure.
Something like that.
Right. It's been a while. And at that time, I think we were talking about how creating a sustainable food network was really vital in terms of protecting us from the ravages of climate change. So we've moved on now to talking about the future of food. And when I think about the future of food, I think about this movie that I saw a number of years ago that was all about conveyor belts of baby chicks and pieces of corn and things, and it was all about agribusiness. How do we transform our sense of the future of food from being that kind of space age view of food coming out of vending machines to being the kind of vision that comes across in this issue of The Nation magazine?
Mm-hmm. Right. It's sort of the future. Is it Soylent or is it soil? Is kind of the dichotomy we're faced with. And what gives me a lot of hope, you mentioned I was on about 9 years ago, and I've been, you know, really all these years been really trying to research and document and then amplify the stories of people who are really writing the future of food, but a future that's really grounded in the soil, grounded in sustainability. And what gives me a lot of hope is that more and more of these communities and farmers groups are networking with each other. And we're really seeing the emergence of a truly global movement of farmers and fisher folk and food producers and their advocates saying, the future of food that we need is one that is grounded in ecological principles, not based on synthetic fertilizer or petroleum-based chemicals. We certainly had hints that that was true a decade or more ago when we realized how severe the climate crisis would likely be. Now that we do see how severe the climate crisis is and the extreme weather events that it will bring, we are seeing more and more evidence that the sustainable farming practices are the kind of practices that create more resiliency in the land, protect us, as you said, from the ravages of climate change, and help promote the biodiversity that we know will really be at the heart of a future of food that actually will nourish us.
Well, as much as I am heartened by what you're describing and what is described in the issue of The Nation, I had this concern because I've, for instance, our local natural food store in Portland started selling farm salmon. And they claim it's wholly sustainable, and it's the kind of farm salmon that's farmed in these giant tanks inland. So I was reading the website of the company that is masterminding this kind of farming of salmon and talking about how this is the food of the future because we're overfishing the waters, and the only way that we can give people the salmon that they want to eat is to find ways to farm it. And I was reading this and thinking, this is like one path down, this is one way down a path that seems to be oblivious to what you're describing. So how do we bridge that gap? I mean, what do we say to people who say that the only solution to feeding the world is through it's basically like the next green revolution, which means, of course, lots mm-hmm. of pesticides and fertilizer, or this idea of farming our fish.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, you know, I don't want to be Pollyanna about this. Clearly, there are incredible forces, including millions, hundreds of millions of investor dollars going in a very different direction than one that I would advocate for and that many of my colleagues are advocating for. So I don't want to be Pollyanna about the opposition or the sort of the counter direction. But what I would say to those people, what does give me hope is that I feel that more and more of us understand and are able to comprehend the importance of understanding a systems analysis, that I think we have evolved and learned so much more about how nature works, how ecology works, of the interdependence of our systems. And I think the climate crisis is perhaps our most bold example of that. But I think when you do get people to scratch a bit beneath the surface of maybe, you know, the beautiful label on the packaging, but to say, well, let's actually peel that back a little bit. Let's actually ask the question of the full story of that food. So in that farm salmon example, well, we know enough to know that we should be asking questions about, well, what is that salmon eating and where is that feed coming from and what are the feedstocks that go into that feed? And we know enough to be asking, well, you know, what are the potential contaminant issues of farming salmon in that way? And what are some of the other ripple effects of when you make that that technology choice? And so I do feel like more and more people are bringing a kind of systems lens to asking questions about their food than, say, we were maybe 10 or 20 years ago. And that's where I feel like a lot of my hope lies, in that you have this huge push, especially in Silicon Valley, for technical fixes of all kinds, including in the food sector. And I think a lot of people are raising important cautions around those technical fixes when it comes to food, asking questions about, well, you know, what are the real implications in terms of health and the environment to some of these technologies that are being pushed as the so-called solutions.
Well, before we get into the positive spin that I really want to spend most of the show on, is one more concern. This turns out there are two farmed salmon companies, and there's this one that's based in Denmark, which now has tanks. They're building tanks in the United States, in Miami, and some other places. And there's another one I've just learned about because the store is now selling this farmed Chinook salmon, which sounds really bizarre. But both of them are certified by the Monterey Bay Aquarium, OceanWise, and a whole number of organizations, which makes me wonder, because the market's using this as an example of why it's okay to sell the food. I mean, the real reason why they're selling the farm salmon is they say that their customers are demanding salmon year-round and don't understand that the salmon runs in the Northwest only happen during certain times of the year. And a lot of these people, I think, are coming from other places where they're used to being able to buy whatever they want, wherever, whenever they want it, and not really thinking about where the food's coming from.
Right. Well, and I'm definitely no expert on the particular case you're talking about. And it'd be really interesting to hear you pose that question to the folks at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, whose seafood guides I've always found to be a valuable piece of information that consumers can use for those who are choosing to consume fish and seafood. What I would say about this example, though, is, and this is kind of what you were getting to in the question, is that it's a great example of how when we think about what are sustainable practices or sustainable, you know, consumer practices, that question isn't just about whether we choose to consume a product or not, but it really is a question of how much we are consuming that product. And so, you know, I personally have a diet that includes fish and seafood. And one of the ways that I feel that I'm best able to make those fish and seafood choices in ways that align with my values around sustainability is that here in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's a huge network of community-supported fisheries. It's a model of purchasing seafood where we're part of a buying club, essentially, that partners directly with folks that are procuring fish or seafood in nearby to us, and we get that fish and seafood once a week, and we're a drop point for other families who pick it up from our house. But it has been this incredible education for me about when certain products are available nearby, and we only eat Dungeness crab maybe two weeks a whole year, and we really enjoy it when we do, but I'm not then going to my market and demanding that I get Dungeness crab every week, every other week of the year. So I think that it is a reminder, I think, to all of us when we're thinking about how we align our consumer choices with our values around environmental sustainability, as well as other values around worker welfare and many other values. And that one of the questions we need to ask is a question of seasonality and scale. You know, how much of a certain product can we consume and still call it sustainable?
We're talking this morning with Anna LaPay, who helped start the Small Planet Institute and is the director of Real Food Media. And she's done a lot of writing and activism around food issues, and was recently the guest editor for a special edition of The Nation magazine about the future of food. Well, I promise we're going to get into some more positive stuff, but I want to continue with some of the challenges that we're facing in terms of really achieving the future of food that you describe in the magazine, Anna. And one of the things that is, there's a very gripping article in the magazine about the use of sprays, particularly glyphosate, and the fight to get that acknowledged to be a potential carcinogen. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that and how that interfaces with the whole push for GMO and what kinds of fight back there is against this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the article that you're referring to is by a veteran journalist, Carrie Gillum. I mean, sorry, it's about glyphosate. And I was going to say, in addition to the article in the issue, one of the best reads out there I'd really recommend to all of your listeners is a book about glyphosate and this battle around the weed killer glyphosate by veteran journalist Carrie Gillum. And so for your listeners, I'm imagining many of them are well aware that genetically engineered crops are now, you know, widely used across the United States and really just a handful of other countries. But really, the U.S. is kind of the guinea pig and the testing ground for genetically engineered crops. And the push for genetic engineering was largely a push by the chemical ag industry to find new profitable products for their pesticides. And one of the most profitable products for the company Monsanto has been this weed killer glyphosate. And the Monsanto brand name for it is Roundup. And there are genetically engineered crops that are resistant to this weed killer known as Roundup Ready. So if you've seen Roundup, that's really a formulation of glyphosate with some other chemicals as well. And what we'd heard for decades from Monsanto and other companies that were selling products with glyphosate was that these were products that were benign and farmers need not worry about using them. And so many farmers took those promises at face value. And what we're seeing now is cases, and this was reported in this article you're referring to in The Nation, but cases of farmers who are getting non-Hodgkin lymphoma primarily, although other illnesses are now being tied to glyphosate use as well. And the article details the stories of some of these farmers, heartbreaking stories of farmers who've faced illness and in cases death that they're associating with glyphosate, and really the pushback by Monsanto against those claims and the efforts that go all the way up to the EPA in the United States and also now in Europe, efforts to try to continue to have glyphosate be allowable as a weed killer in the U.S. and in the EU. And to me, it was really a powerful article. And again, the book by Carrie Gillum, Whitewash, powerful book that speaks to the collusion often between industry and government regulators, as well as speaks to the real threat of chemical agriculture on our health, not just for farmers and farm workers, but also for consumers as well.
Well, as distressing as the possible impacts that glyphosate has on the health of farm workers and probably also people who eat the food, there's the cover-up to me was, well, it's very reminiscent reminiscent of the merchants of doubt, to take a phrase from somebody else, who are, you know, who were very successful in postponing the understanding, the acknowledgement, and the taking action against the severe health risks of cigarettes, and now the severe health risks of climate change. So let's talk a little bit about the comparison between what Monsanto and other agribusiness giants did, but particularly Monsanto, to really obfuscate the research about how dangerous glyphosates might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and I think that parallel is totally appropriate. And what we've seen, and this is documented in this article, and again, reporting by Carrie Gillum, has shown that there was a real cover-up on the part of the company as there were increasing cases, evidence, research that was showing these possible toxic effects of the weed killer. And in the article, they're actually referring to exchanges between Monsanto and EPA regulators. And what's been really interesting to see is that actually, as a result of this class action lawsuit that farmers, hundreds of farmers, have filed against Monsanto, as a result of that class action lawsuit, there's been a trove of documents that have been part of that lawsuit, a trove of documents that have come out in discovery. And this has also been the case in kind of previous cases against other corporations that are faced with class action lawsuits around toxic chemical exposure, that the discovery process actually helps us, the public, really see behind the curtain and to see some of that collusion and to see it in email exchanges, to see it in pretty strong evidence that there was pressure by Monsanto on regulators to downplay the risks. We also see it, again, in these documents that have been found in discovery, this really direct, concerted effort by Monsanto to defame the scientists behind the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, which was the agency that several years ago reviewed all of the science on glyphosate and came to the conclusion that the chemical was a probable carcinogen. And in the wake of that finding, Monsanto, and again, this has been really, really spelled out quite clearly in Carrie Gillum's research, but it's been really clear that Monsanto has really tried to undermine the scientists that were part of that deliberative process and really try to undermine those findings, which were pretty remarkable and alarming. And you know, why does Monsanto care so much about this issue and about this particular product? Because if you look at Monsanto's books, you will see that glyphosate and the genetically engineered crops that are formulated to be resistant to glyphosate are a huge part of their portfolio. That if the United States were to, say, ban the use of Roundup Ready, you know, Roundup, which is Monsanto's brand name for glyphosate, if the U.S. were to ban that, if the EU in these last deliberations, these last few months, there was a discussion of possibly the EU not reauthorizing the use of glyphosate across the EU, you know, if that were to happen, it would be a really existential threat to the company. And so this is, you know, a huge issue for Monsanto, the company. And again, I think we've seen this great reporting, both in The Nation and from Carrie Gillum's book, Whitewash, that really helps us, the general public, again, go behind that curtain and see the kind of ways in which the companies that are selling glyphosate have really tried to delay and to deflect concern over the toxicity of this chemical.
I was talking this morning with Anna LaPay, who's a food writer, activist, and the director of Real Food Media, and we're talking about the future of food, which is the subject of a special edition of The Nation magazine that came out on October 30th, and she was the special editor for that. So now, as I promised Anna, we're going to talk about something positive. And one of the articles that really I really enjoyed was called Hacking the Grain. So tell me, what is Kernza?
Sure. Well, first, I just want to also give a shout out to supporting your local radio station. I'm a member of my local public radio station here in the Bay Area, so it's fun to be on when you guys are having your pledge drive here. And for those of you listening and supporting, thank you so much. So what is Kernza? Yeah, I loved this article, and I actually have had the pleasure of eating this grain. And for those of you who have not heard of Kernza, which is probably most of you, it is a grain that has been developed that is just starting to be used in products you could consume, like bread. And the idea was to create, breed a grain that would be a perennial. So a perennial, for those of you who don't know, is a crop that grows year to year. You don't have to plant it. And the idea would be to grow a grain that would actually taste a lot like wheat, but you wouldn't have to plant it. And these folks have been working on this for decades out of the University of Minnesota and the Land Institute in Kansas. And they've been doing breeding trials. And just in the last few years, the breeding trials have resulted in a product that that some chefs and restaurateurs are actually starting to use in their breads and in beer as well. And it's to me, it was, yes, a really exciting story about a really exciting potential future of what our Midwest might look like.
So how is this grain different from wheat? I'm actually looking at the photograph in the article, and the miller has, in one hand, he's holding a palm full of wheat, in the other hand, a palm full of Kernza. And it looks to me like, for one thing, Kernza is like narrower and longer than wheat, but how would you describe the difference in terms of taste and in terms of how easy it is to bake into pastries?
Well, you know, there's still quite a lot of differences, and one of the things is that this is still a work in progress. And so they're still continuing to breed it to try to have it be a flavor profile that is closer to the wheat that we're familiar with. But again, it's a type of grain, and as you all know, grains are really refer to any plant that humans eat that's also part of the botanical family of grasses. And typically, the most common grains in the world are corn, wheat, and rice. But most of those, except for some rices, most of those are annual crops. And so the difference, as I mentioned, is that it would be a perennial crop that you would not have to plant. And then what they're finding is that they're trying to get it to have a flavor profile closer to the wheat that we know of, but the way it is coming out today, some of the challenges for those that are trying to turn it into, say, bread or use it in cooking is that all of our milling, all of those production processes are designed for that commercialized wheat that we're more familiar with. And so they're still kind of evolving it to get the flavor profile closer. But I have had Kernza bread, and it is really delicious, I have to say.
So can you make it, can you use it in all kinds of pastries? I noticed in the article, one of the bakeries or cafes, actually, that was one of the first pilot programs for Kernza. I'm not even sure that they were using it in bread, but they were using it more in other pastries.
Yeah, so they're using it in pastries, and then in this restaurant here in San Francisco that is actually called The Perennial is using it in kind of their signature bread. And, you know, at the moment, there is not a huge amount of Kernza being produced, and so if you listeners would like to try it, you know, it's not widely available yet. But, yes, people are trying it in pastries and trying it in bread, and it's definitely, you know, part of the experimentation is not just how it's being grown, but then how you can cook with it. And to me, I also think that Kernza is, you know, maybe the most kind of extreme example of trying to experiment with a more sustainable wheat. But all across the country, there are farmers that are trying to bring back heirloom varieties of grains that are better for our bodies, are healthier for us, and that are produced more sustainably, and move away from this hyper-commercialized wheat that uses a lot of chemicals in the production, as well as, you know, to tie it to our last conversation about glyphosate, a lot of commercial wheat growers actually spray their crop with glyphosate just before harvesting, and so a lot of health advocates are concerned about glyphosate residues on non-organic wheat products in the United States. So the Kernza story is kind of part of this broader story about really rethinking broadly what we're growing and trying to diversify what we're growing here in the United States.
Well, why is it important that we start growing perennial grains as opposed to the annual grains like wheat, corn, and rice?
Well, the vision behind this experiment, again, dates back to researchers at the Land Institute in Kansas, and the vision was really came out of their kind of looking at the landscape across most of the Midwest and thinking about you know, what would it look like to bring back the prairies that existed across our Midwest, but to bring them back with a crop that we could actually consume and could nourish us. So it dates back to the 70s and to the founder of the Land Institute, Wes Jackson, and to really his having this incredible, 50-year, 100-year vision of why couldn't we create a farm that looks more like the prairie and that has a collection of annuals and perennials growing side by side, and as a result would be much less energy intensive to produce, much more nourishing to the soil and retaining much more topsoil and benefiting the carbon sequestration that would come from that in the soils, and then also providing us with a really nourishing crop.
Well, I was just reading an article this morning about concerns about there being another Dust Bowl. and talking about, you know, that actually out of the Dust Bowl disaster came the Soil and Conservation Corps. And, and until, I'm not sure what's happening with the Trump administration, but mandate that in order for farmers to get crop insurance, they have to have a conservation plan. How would growing Kernza help farmers to prevent another Dust Bowl from happening?
So one of the most amazing photographs I've seen, agricultural photographs I've seen, is a photograph that hangs at this restaurant, the Perennial, that sells this, that serves this bread that we're talking about, made from Kernza perennial grains. And it's a photograph of the root systems of the Kernza plant. And it hangs horizontally across the entire restaurant, because if it were vertical and really, you know, the direction the roots actually grow, the ceiling is not high enough at the restaurant for it to hang that direction. And what it's really showing off is this incredible root system of the perennial crop called Kernza. And what that incredible root system that goes so deep does for the soil is it really helps to strengthen the soil. It helps to support the microorganisms in the soil. It helps to aerate the soil. It helps to do all the things to soil that we know are need to happen to help keep soil in place, to help keep soil resilient and in place when times of incredible rains that otherwise the soil, if it didn't have that kind of strength and it didn't have that root structure, the soil would get run off and wash away. Or during times of drought, if it didn't have that incredible strength and root structure and all those microorganisms in times of drought, it would get blown away. And we can imagine those, you know, the images of the Dust Bowl might come to mind. And so, you know, when Wes Jackson had this vision, this 50, 100-year vision to really change, to really rethink our Midwest, to bring back those prairies, you know, in his mind, it was a vision that was both a vision for human health and a more nourishing crop. It was a vision around sustainability, a crop that wouldn't take as much energy to produce. And it was a vision around how do we prevent another Dust Bowl? You know, how do we promote the kind of healthy soil that's really essential to healthy food and farming systems?
Well, if you're just tuning in this morning, we're talking with Anna LaPay, who's food writer and activist and director of the Real Food Media. And she was recently the guest editor for a special issue of The Nation called The Future of Food. And the subtitle is Setting the Table for the Next Generation. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about that next generation of farmers. But now we're going to talk with Per and Teresa about why you need to call 877-500-5266 and become a member of KABU this moment.
Well, because KABU is your nourishment. KABU nourishes you about the truth of what's going on in this world of ours. It's your world, folks, and corporations are trying to take it away from you. Give us a call, 877-500-5266. Help keep this station on for another year. We've been on now for 49 years, fighting against the corporations and the government bureaucracies and theocracies and boobocracies, but we are here still. And thanks to you, because the people out there in Radio Land have been giving their money and giving their time and their love and solidarity to keep the station on the air. 877-500-5266. The real thing about the corporate world is that they need us more than we need them.
Yeah, that gives me ideas. Why don't you join Leah, who is renewed from Northeast, and Carol from Monmouth. These people have called in. They have called in, and they have joined thousands of others who understand how important KBOO is and understand the fact that this is what makes KABU KABU. The fact that we depend on your individual contributions, that's what keeps us in your corner, as opposed to in the pockets of Archer Daniels Midland or the Koch brothers, that sort of thing. We don't have that constant pressure to water down our content or to provide reactionary content that you can hear on so many other radio broadcasts. We are still here after nearly 50 years doing your work because of what the way that we are structured. We're your radio station. So you understand now that you're the sort of person who pulls the society forward, who makes a socialist contribution towards the society, that little extra bit that you can do, that $10 a month that you can kick in, and we would love to give you a knit cap or a book. And you can call us right now at 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-5266 and make it happen.
You are doing it for yourself and you are doing it for the next generation, because when they grow up, they're growing up in a world that is informed by KBOO, and they keep this tradition going. 877-500-5266. For a $75 pledge, which is only $6.25 a month, you can get a digital subscription to The Nation magazine. That is one of our, we are not alone in this world of informing the public. We have our friends and allies. The Nation magazine is one of them. So give us a call, 877-500-5266. Do it now.
Thanks, Perrin. Thanks, Teresa. We're talking this morning with Anna LaPay, who is the director of Real Food Media, longtime food writer and activist, and we're talking about the future of food. So before we get into the last thought about who is going to be responsible for creating this future of food for us, I just wanted a little bit more to finish with grains, because you mentioned that besides having working on a perennial grain like Kernza, that there's also a lot of other there's a lot of farmers going back to raising more heirloom grains. And in fact, there's a farm down in the Willamette Valley, Stafford Seed Farms, that my partner Elaine Velasquez and I featured in our film Gaining Ground, who have been experimenting with, well, for one thing, just raising organic red wheat, hard red wheat in the Willamette Valley, which they were told they couldn't do. But they also started branching out into another wide range besides quinoa and spelt. I mean, there were some other grains I'd never heard of. So I wanted to find out, well, what are these grains that people can choose from besides just buying conventional wheat?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, this is one of those storylines that I get a lot of hope from, which is, as you're describing, farmers that are really experimenting with all of these alternatives. And so there are many. I think one of the more popular ones that people might have already been cooking with is farro. It's, again, an heirloom grain that kind of an ancient wheat species that is I love cooking with it. I think it's delicious. It's really healthy. Again, it's kind of a gets us off of our just commercialized wheat focus. There's also spelt, which again is kind of one of the more popular ones. There is kamut, which is a grain that I don't cook with, but I eat it in cereal. There's various natural cereal companies that are starting to use a lot of these ancient grains. And what I've seen, and there are many, many others, but I mentioned just those. Amaranth is another one. Millet is another one I love cooking with, especially with baked goods. It adds really great texture and kind of crunch. You mentioned quinoa. But what I would add to this, in addition to just listing the names of some of these products you can cook with at home, is to me what I've seen in different pockets around the country, and maybe it's happening in your area too, as you described, are farmers getting together and thinking about what are the kind of economic structures that we can build to help support farmers and farmer networks to experiment with these different grains and find markets for them. So here in the San Francisco Bay Area, for instance, a restaurateur and entrepreneur started a new cooperative called Community Grains and worked with farmers on land kind of in the outlying greater San Francisco Bay Area and other parts of Northern California, and helped to secure a pretty significant USDA grant to invest in a new processing facility that would support the processing of some of these more heirloom or artisanal grains, and provided these farmers with support in terms of marketing and kind of a packaging and brand recognition in the marketplace. And now when I go to my locally owned grocery store, I can buy community grains, wheat, that is made with one of these heirloom varieties, and that's supporting farmers that are kind of taking this leap to grow different products. For many years, lived in New York City, and there's kind of a similar movement happening in the Hudson Valley north of New York City, where farmers are experimenting with these new kinds of grains, selling them directly to customers at farmers markets, but also coming together to develop kind of the packaging and marketing to reach customers in supermarkets. And I think this is a great way that we can think about diversifying what farmers are growing, as well as finding more nourishing sources of food for ourselves.
Well, now let's get to the most exciting thing, I think, which is who is going to be creating this future of food for us? You mentioned in the beginning about there being young farmers who are inspired to take very different routes than the past generations of agribusiness farmers. So do you see that there really is like a movement of young farmers that could really change the way we think about food?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is. There really is. And of course, there are huge barriers to young farmers being able to find land and be successful on the land. And those barriers tend to be structural economic ones, not barriers in terms of the success rate of sustainable farming. To me, one of one of my heroes in this work is a woman named Lindsay Shute, who is one of the directors at the National Young Farmers Coalition, which is a relatively new network of young farmers across the country. To me, the fact that there is a National Young Farmers Coalition, that there's enough, you know, farmers to form a coalition, is itself a sign that there's a real hunger out there among young people to get on the land. And what they work on a range of different policies and programs to support young farmers. And they also do an annual survey of their members and ask their farmer members, you know, what are the barriers you face, and then work as a coalition to try to remove those barriers or lessen those barriers. And just to give one example that they found in their surveys of young farmers, is one of the big things they found among young people who want to get into farming is the burden of student debt. And that is a burden that prevents many young people from getting into farming, or makes it really hard if they decide to take that path. And so the National Young Farmers Coalition, one of the policies they've been advocating for is a policy that would add the profession of farming to the list of professions that you can pursue and have your student debt either completely forgiven after a decade or significantly relieved. And so that's one example of a policy that they're advocating for. Of course, in this political moment, that battle becomes even more complicated, as you have an administration that's doing all kinds of things to make it a lot harder for all young people to get out from under the yoke of student debt. But that's just an example of one of the things that this coalition is really working toward. And I think their story, that they do have so many young people that want to be part of the coalition and that are really working together to try to make farming a more viable option for young people, is a sign that that there are young people who want to be on the land and who want to be part of that future of food.
Well, Anna, it's always great to talk to you, and it'd be really nice actually to continue this conversation at a later date when we're not interrupted by pledge breaks.
But honestly, I don't mind them at all. I think it's fabulous that you guys are reaching out to your community, and I urge everybody to join in supporting what you do. It's so important.
And I thank you so much for your help. And maybe we'll be in touch about continuing this conversation down the line.
That sounds great.
Before we go out, I wanted to just mention, amongst all the really bizarre news of the last week, there was some really good news that last week started with, which is that the Washington State Energy Facility Siting Council unanimously opposed permitting the Vancouver Energy's oil-by-rail terminal they want to put into Vancouver, Washington. It would be the largest oil-by-rail terminal in North America. It's now on to Governor Jay Inslee to make the final decision, but FSEC's decision, their unanimous decision, was very heartening for people who've been working for years to stop this terminal. So despite some other bad news like this tax bill, which we need to fight in the next few days, it was good to know that the people power had really made an effect in at least preserving the Northwest for now from becoming a center for fossil fuel exports. So You've been today we were talking with food writer and activist Anna LaPay, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this week, later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Travis Williams with Willamette Riverkeeper about cleaning up the Willamette's problematic Superfund site. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the rest of the day.
Seagulls come down and they squawk at me down where the water skis.